Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by. Welcome to the Talky Bit. For those of you that didn't notice, I have been away.
It's like it's the
summer. More correctly, Karine and I have been away. And part of that time, the majority of it, but not all of it, has been spent traveling in Scotland. And a little bit more about why Scotland another time. There was a reason. It wasn't just like throw a dart at a globe and go there. Unlike the other Tim, I wasn't working, or at least I wasn't there sort of in the service of my employer with direct work responsibilities. Now, having said that, the sort of work that I do often involves the collection of stories. And so there's a part of me that's always on. And at this point in my life, it just feels like a built-in thing. People are interesting. Their stories are interesting. What we make as a species, what we use to tell stories about whatever it is that matters to us is something that I find interesting. So those things catch my attention, and I sometimes collect things to help me remember them. When I was a kid, I had this jean jacket, and it wasn't like one of those classic, you know, like belt-length cool Levi's ones. It was a longer, dorkier one. But I liked it, and for several years, whenever we traveled as a family, and this was sort of adolescent years for me, I collected sew-on patches, and my mom, bless her, sewed them onto this jacket. It was an inexpensive, colorful way to carry memories. I have no actual idea where that jacket ended up, but my recollection is that by the time I stopped wearing it, it was mostly patches that were holding the jacket together. Like it was pretty done, but the patches were still there. I still collect things that help me remember. And perhaps not surprisingly, they're still often visual. And so now when we travel, one of the primary ways that I carry memories is as photographs. And I've noticed over the years that there are some photographic themes that I keep returning to. Doorways. I really like doorways. I like what doorways open into. I like when doorways open into things that are a surprise. I like when architecture opens into things that are far bigger than the architecture can contain. So these are things that over the years of taking pictures of places that are not familiar to me that I've noticed. I like landscapes as memories, especially ones that have a lot of sky. And when you're in Scotland, the sky is always doing things. It's not always doing the things you want it to do because it rains a lot. But there's always drama in the sky. It's never like that notion of a Manitoba bluebird, you know, like there's no clouds sky. I think if that happened in Scotland, it'd be like a great big snowstorm here. They'd just shut the whole place down for the day. They wouldn't know what to do. But that always calls out to me. I think maybe it's the prairie person in me. And another thing that keeps calling out to me are signs. Literal signs in unusual places, signs that are used in an unfamiliar way, or they use unfamiliar language, or they use familiar language in ways that I'm not familiar with, signs that no longer signify what they once did. Those really intrigue me. Just all kinds of signs. Sometimes signs require some interpretation, and I enjoy playing around with the possibilities, imagining what they might mean, trying to imagine what the intent was, if it's not clear at this point because of circumstance. So here's one. Let me just illustrate what I mean. So here's a sign that we came across. If you know what that phrase means, don't spoil this, okay? So signs is no fly tipping. So if you're listening on the podcast, we're looking at a picture of a sign that the text simply says no fly tipping. So my first thought is that like cow tipping? You know, like, because if it is, but it's flies, Like, that's both hilarious and absurd. Like, that's just where my brain goes with that. Maybe if you've been walking around, you know, a hilly Scottish city or a landscape all day, usually at high speed because I'm trying to keep Corrine in sight, I might feel like that sign is speaking directly to how I feel, like flying off the hiking trail or tipping over or both, and it's encouraging me to keep going. Or if it's on the fence, like outside a restaurant, maybe it clarifies this recurring traveling question is, do you tip here? And then it would be a relief. Maybe it's on the side of a narrow Scottish road. There's no shoulder, and there's these deep, boggy ditches, which is pretty much the norm in a lot of the areas where we were driving, in which case it might feel like some sort of an absurd insult. You know, like, so what's going on? And really, neither of those last two explains the fly part of the sign, so some interpretation is required. So good news in this case is there was more information on the sign that I'm showing you. So right underneath this, it said that. It said, pick it up. Right? So it's referring to something that could otherwise be discarded. Huh? Now, yeah. Here's the rest of the sign. So that's the whole sign.
Dumb dumpers.
Yeah, I know. If you see any dumb dumpers. Fly tipping, it turns out, is a phrase that means illegal disposal of trash, leaving it on the side of the road, throwing it in the river, leaving it in the middle of an empty field. That sort of thing. So no fly tipping. Pick it up. Glasgow, this is in Glasgow, where there's been a concerted civic effort to try to clean up the city. So there's lots of different campaigns around that that speak to this. And this is one of them. So some interpretation required. So I want to move on from that to some of the other sorts of signs I collected. These are maybe a little more serious. The history of religion, and particularly the Christian religion, and the political and cultural history of Scotland are inextricably intertwined. One of the major themes of that enmeshment is independence from Britain. I'm not going to get a lot of history here. I'm going to represent a long period of it in one paragraph, so you can just hang on for the ride, or you can just la-la-la your way through this bit, whatever. But this is a little bit of context. So Scotland was an independent kingdom through the Middle Ages. They fought wars to maintain their independence from England. Those two kingdoms were united in what was called a personal union, so between rulers in 1603. Scottish King James VI becomes King James I of England, so he's king of both at the same time, but with a different number after his name. These two kingdoms are united politically into one kingdom. It gets called Great Britain, so this happens in 1707. That movement united the countries, which ended the wars of independence that were going on, and it created, what I have in my notes here is relative peace, and what I mean by that is sort of what Tim referred to when he quoted Dallaire the other week as saying more like a series of ceasefires. That's not the same as peace, but it ended open conflict between those two nations. Political campaigns for Scottish self-government begin in the 19th century, initially in the form of demands for home rule within the United Kingdom. So we're still going to want to be part of the UK, but we want to govern ourselves. Not precisely analogous, but related to conversations about that we sometimes have on this continent, about what it would mean to be an independently governed state sort of within a union, that kind of a notion. And then there's two referendums on devolution, so moving away from that. They're in 1979, 1997, so relatively recent. And then in 1999, there's an actual Scottish parliament that's established. So a relatively new parliament in that country, which is a very thoughtfully designed parliamentary space as well, that consistently architecturally makes the point that the people are watching. It's kind of cool. Now, I've left out all the information about what that meant for the religious conflicts that accompanied and often drove the political ones. This was deeply intertwined. And again, to reference something that Tim pointed out last week, in the Middle Ages and previous to that and subsequent to that on occasion, still, ruler comes into power, you become their religion. We are now this religion, not that religion, or this version of a religion, or not that version of a religion. All of that sort of stuff is woven in there. How we summarize that will really depend on what perspective we're looking at it from. One of my main feelings when I encounter a chunk of history like that, one of my main emotions is sadness. I'm when I'm in a grand old cathedral, I'm reading the explainer panels about how there used to be this stunning colored stained glass before the Protestant reformers trashed it all because they believed God wanted them to, or some other cathedral that escaped all that somehow still bathed in this gilded opulence because the builders believed that that's what was consistent with their views of the divine. Having those kind of experiences, I mean, amazing, privileged experiences, astonishing spaces, and also I find myself in a complex emotional space where I'm both deeply appreciating the splendor or the grandeur of what I'm seeing, but I'm also feeling at the same time like, really? Like, is this the best that can come from the story that we call Christianity? Like, is this really the best we could do with the energy of that story? Because the way the existence of these places is often explained is along the lines of King so-and-so built this palace for the baptism of his son. Like those kinds of sentences, which you stand back from them one small step and you realize that they're absurdly simplistic, among other things. Not untrue, just incomplete. They leave out an awful lot about how the place got built and by whom, at what cost to the people of the time, all those kinds of things. So, with that as a bit of a backdrop, I'm going to move into three signs that I encountered in different locations in Scotland that felt like signs that we as humans can do better, whether that's in the context of the religion that forms the context for all these signs or some other take on mystery and meaning-making. So that's to sort of set this up a little bit. As it happens, all three of these are geographically from Glasgow. Glasgow is a bit of a grim industrial place overall. It's not usually sort of a first call place if you're visiting Scotland as a tourist. That would be Edinburgh, but with plenty of delightful surprises when you dig a little deeper. I am incredibly fortunate to be partnered with somebody who's an expert at digging a little deeper. And so we had a great time in Glasgow, including there's a remarkable public civic commitment to public art in the form of large wall murals. That are all over the city, and they're sort of dispersed. If you want to see all whatever 30 of them or however many were in the app that we were using to find them, you got to go for quite a hike. But they are astonishing, and if you're ever in Glasgow, worth taking the however much time it takes to trot around and find them. Not what we're looking at today, but pretty intriguing. Now, first sign in this particular gathering of signs arrived. We were walking around Glasgow. I think we were actually looking for some of those murals. And we came across this, I'm going to say, relatively little church called St. George's Tron that had, and this, by the way, falls under genuine miracles, okay? Like, should get verified and all of that. They had free public washrooms. I'll use some photographs of locations that aren't mine because you had to have a drone and a clear day to get them in some instances, or, you know, just get lucky. So this is that relatively little church. You can see that it's really not that big if you think window, door, window. But they still managed to, you know, the spire is bigger than the rest of the church. So it wasn't billed, like if you walked up to the front door, it wasn't advertising itself as a church. I mean, architecturally it was, but it was actually advertising itself as a cafe called the Wild Olive Tree. And when you went inside, it was bright, it was welcoming, unlike so many surviving religious spaces in the UK. And as soon as you walked in, you discovered that it had a strong social justice kind of vibe about it. That won't necessarily be apparent in the photograph, but you can see that it inside it doesn't look or feel anything like the period that the architecture of the outside suggests that it would. It was connected to a social housing project, connected to a shelter, those kind of expressions of sort of care and support for folks that are having a difficult time in the area. And we weren't looking to stop and eat. The miracle, as I said, was the bathroom. But we were promptly and warmly invited to come in and have a look around. There's this lovely woman who identified herself as part of the community of St. George's. She made it abundantly clear there was no obligation whatsoever if we came in, offered a bit of an explanation of what they were on about and all of that. And then in the course of sort of walking around the space, and if you look to the right side of the photograph, you can see a painting of a person and a portrait. It's just behind the chairs there. It's a small detail in a big picture. Behind that, there's another picture that is on ongoing display in the space. And when I saw it, it sort of stopped me in my tracks. It's called Our Last Supper. And it's an obvious nod to one of the most famous paintings in the history of Christian art, Christian religious art, which is, of course, of Jesus' last meal with all of his disciples. In particular, there's lots of versions of that that have been painted, but the sort of immortalized one is Da Vinci's painting that, you know, all of us have sort of seen some version or other of this, right? Here's an interesting thing. When you look at Our Last Supper, that painting, and The Last Supper, if you look at them side by side, what's one of it? I have a particular answer in mind for myself, but what's one of the first things that strikes you as different between the two. Position of the table, one's rotated a different direction than the other. Yeah. And it's not on one plane, right? It's got a sense of depth to the contemporary one that isn't there in the High Renaissance.
They're sitting one. Across from each other rather than along inside.
Mm-hmm.
Eat.
Yeah. Like it was an actual meal.
Jesus isn't identified. There's no one leader identified there.
Yeah. And that one, Heidi, that's that there's no one leader identified. That's the one that really struck me. It's like there's no central figure, right? In Da Vinci's painting. I mean, aside from the fact that it's mathematically perfectly balanced and Jesus is backlit, even if it wasn't obvious from other, you know, things, you could just do it, just do the math. So it's like structurally, these are two different stories. And it turns out that this was very deliberate. The models for the painting are all folks from that community, mostly people that are unhoused, some of whom our helpful host explained have since died. It's not an especially old painting, but people who've had difficult lives in many ways. The artist, a guy named Ian Campbell, said that he felt that it was important to him that no one stood out as a conventional Christ figure. It turns out that in many ways, this whole endeavor, the Wild Olive Cafe, the things that are going on there, I mean, come in there and buy a muffin and you're paying for somebody who can, all you have to do is walk in there, identify as unhoused, and they'll feed you. But it's not a shelter. It's an operating cafe. And I don't know how many of you have had the privilege of traveling, but a lot of times cafes and those kind of spaces are fairly guarded enterprises. Like, you want to use the bathroom, buy something. You know, they don't necessarily feel public as much as they feel like an enterprise that's adjacent to the public sometimes. This one had an openness about it that was wildly different than that. And it intrigued me enough to dig a little deeper, and it turns out the whole enterprise, the whole endeavor, stands on a different notion about the preeminent figure of Christianity. If you go around the back of the church building, you'll find this. It's a sculpture. And the figure on the bench is, perhaps, of course, Jesus. And when I first saw this sculpture, when we walked around the back, it looked like this. See the difference? Bit of a Where's Waldo? Let me give it to you again. So there's one thing that's different about those two photographs other than my perspective, which changed a bit. What's different between the two images, this one and this one, is the vodka bottle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's just peeking out. And it's not quite empty. Somebody had left it there, which there's a part of me that was kind of like, come on, you know, like, let's just have the experience with this already. But there's another part of me that sort of felt like, well, maybe that's not that inappropriate, given the fact that Jesus' first public miracle was to make a bunch of booze for a bunch of people who had already been drinking for several days. But, you know, anyway, I thought it was interesting. But here's the thing. The point of the sculpture is, you know, almost certainly not that. The point, I think, has something quite directly to do with this notion that if we want to encounter the mystery of the divine sort of with skin on, enfleshed, incarnated, to use a theological word for it, in our everyday lives, the place that we're most likely to do that is with whomever our society regards as lesser. We might typically think of that as sort of falling under, like, social enterprise. Let's help the downtrodden, not a bad thing. But I actually think the idea is a lot bigger than that. If we think more about whomever you or I might regard as, never mind lesser, just other than ourselves on whatever basis, then we're actually on the right track. Instead of sort of Jesus is our guy and what we believe about him is correct and if we have to kill you to prove it, we will, I think it's more along the lines of if you want to see God, then take a good long look at the person you're in proximity to, no matter what their circumstances are, and show them love and kindness. And that's how the divine shows up in the world, and we actually notice. It's sort of like Loretta McKinnitt, songwriter, who says, you know, like, eat your veggies, brush your teeth, get enough sleep, and be ready for the surprise, right? Like, so do what we can, but there's a part of this that's a mystery. We could say maybe that it's more about being present to something mysterious than it is about trying to make something happen. And I don't know, most of us in the room have grown up around religion. Personally, I can think of considerable energy that's been expended trying to make something happen that goes well beyond just being ready. So here's a community whose response to their growing sense that the way their religion was expressing itself was increasingly irrelevant to their surroundings and to the needs of the population in that part of the city, and perhaps entirely missing the point of its own central figure. So they totally changed course. They altered not only the building, but they altered their reason for being, for remaining present in ways that in very practical terms said, all are welcome. They actually just found ways to actually enact that. That one painting, Our Last Supper, that's part of a series that is housed at St. George's, permanently kind of in the space, by an artist in residence that they had in the program, the person I quoted earlier. They don't display them all at any one time, but Our Last Supper is sort of, I think, the one that sort of stays out all the time. And then they rotate the other ones in the space, but you can buy a booklet that has prints of all of them in it. And the project, which is called the Gospel Sketchbook. It's all based on stories from the person who was showing us around couldn't remember which gospel. She said, I can't remember which gospel. And I'm like, it had to be Luke. Like, you know, and it is, of course, the Gospel of Luke, which is the gospel that most vigorously sends the message that this Jesus story is for everybody, not for a particular tribe. And, you know, you don't have to purchase the book, of course. There's no obligation. This place felt to me like a sign of spiritual life in the places that we were seeing. The second sign is more complex for me because it was adjacent to a literal graveyard, which included, as many of these religious spaces are, which included this intriguingly enigmatic tombstone, which says, in memory of Sundays, 1977 to 1983. Those were particularly good Sundays. I don't know. Anyway, it was just like in the middle of this massive, you know, graveyard surrounding the main cathedral in Glasgow. This was one of the tombstones. We did want to see the main cathedral in Glasgow. It was worth the visit, even if only because it's a rare instance of an intact pre-Reformation Gothic cathedral. And the reason those are rare, of course, is because the reformers under Knox just were like, this isn't the way God wants it. And they tore them down. Not my photograph because, again, perfect day. And also when we were there, that top spire was entirely shrouded in a hanging scaffold for restoration, which is not unusual. But that's what it looks like when you just walk into the main entry to the Glasgow Cathedral. And it's one of those places where my sense of what a waste was quite stirred up because the Protestant reformers had trashed the place. They'd destroyed the original stained glass. They'd ripped out all the interior chapels. They'd left the building intact. No small part, probably because all the destruction sort of happened because of their own austere take on how they think God wants people to worship. So that's all drawn from First Testament texts that have to do no graven images and no other gods before me and so on. And they felt like the way the Catholic Church, sort of writ large, had represented their worship violated that spirit of that text. And so they were going to make that right. It doesn't look that austere in the photographs because of the restoration, so you kind of have to imagine how ornate it might have been before the reformers, you know, got their hands on it. It still looks pretty ornate to our eyes. This is our cathedral right here, so compared to that, you know, right? Now, as is often the case, the main cathedral is only part of kind of a complex. And in this instance, one of the adjacent buildings, which was built on the foundations of a Middle Ages building that's long gone, and they built another one, is a museum. And it's called the St. Mungo Museum of Religious Life and Art. And so it's a kind of a contemporary take on a, you know, old building, right? Okay, so now, it's noteworthy that this is run by the city of Glasgow, so not by any particular religious institution.
And free washrooms.
And it had free washrooms. Yeah. Yeah. We did some pretty creative washroom finding, gotta say. I'm not going to tell any stories about that. I'm not going to make any excuses for going to see a place called a religious museum. For a guy who believes that we are in the midst of, or the radical transformation of, the previously dominant expressions of all three of the monotheistic religions, a museum of religious life sounds about right. Don't you think? I mean, it's sort of kind of along the lines of In Memory of Sundays, you know? I mean, museums are where you go to see things that are consigned to the past, right? Well, I've had the privilege of seeing quite a few museums. And in fact, we're going to end our tour of these three signs in yet another museum. And one thing that I've learned is that what I'm going to call the good ones still have something to say and not just about the past. The good ones poke us and make us think about the future. This one, however, took me totally by surprise. I was kind of like, yeah, we should pop in there. You know, we kind of have these conversations sometimes when we're traveling together. Do you want to see this? Do you want to, you know, do we take the time for this? Because there's this other thing and you're always making these decisions. And we said, let's have a look. So we walked in and it was immediately apparent that what I thought was going to be a walk through the history of Christianity in Scotland wasn't. And it doesn't say that in the title of the museum. The museum is called the St. Mungo Museum of Religious Life and Art in Scotland, not of Christianity. So the information was in front of me, but I had interpreted it already. This is going to be about Christianity, right? And it really wasn't. It was actually a remarkably even-handed history of how different world religions mark life passages with meaning-making rituals, complete with objects from those cultures and rituals, voices and stories from each of them, all offered up as equally valid expressions of people's attempts to touch the divine. That's how the museum was laid out. This is the opening description. When you come in the first panel to your right, you know, in the exhibit, right, where you stop to kind of go, where am I? And you read, I'll read it. From birth to death and beyond, rituals mark the different stages of human life. Through prayer, meditation, singing, music, and dance, people try to approach the sacred. Religious beliefs sometimes reinforce the social order, and at other times cause revolution, war, and death. Religion can also inspire people to live better lives so they may receive blessings now. An interesting take on a better life, don't you think? I thought that was a fascinating sentence. People to live better lives so they may receive blessings now or be better prepared for the afterlife. So that's what the displays were about. Really thoughtfully curated space, all about that. And I just, the sign just hints at it, but also in other languages, and not just other languages, but other scripts for language. So from other cultures thoroughly, even in terms of the text that was in the space. I'm not going to get into sort of the details of this too much. There are a couple of things that I just popped a couple of photographs in here. This is so they went through kind of all the major life stages. So birth, coming of age. There was one on sex and marriage. There was one on death. There was one on war. I think actually I popped a slide in about that. War and peace. Death, of course. So all these different life passages, right? And they'd kind of just really, like I said, really even-handedly lay this stuff out. This was, for me, a museum that punched above its weight. Not least of all, they had a couple of contemporary paintings from an artist, a war artist. War photography, I was familiar with. War art, I wasn't, in the sense of contemporary, who'd been in Bosnia. And just a couple of, man, if you spent more than a minute in front of a couple of these paintings, you couldn't get them out of your head. This might seem like a strange analogy, but just stay with me. Scotland is, among other things, the home of Scotch, the whiskey. And I'm not much of a drinker in general. It's not a moral strength. This stuff just makes me sleepy. I prefer to take in my discretionary calories as cheesecake. But I've only had what I've been told it was good Scotch twice in my life. So I am the opposite of an authority on this. What I can tell you by personal experience is that judging by the storefront advertising in Edinburgh, where it seems like every second shop features something to do with Scotch, there are literally hundreds, maybe thousands of different kinds of Scotch. I can tell you by observation that sampling them is a desirable pastime for lots of folks who are visiting Scotland. And I can tell you that people get pretty passionate about it, that they put all kinds of resources into it, that they make lots of money doing business with it. If you're walking around Edinburgh, you will go past Johnny Walker's headquarters, which is a staggering piece of contemporary architecture. I think it's like six floors, right on a downtown corner, right next to the old city. It just shouts contemporary wealth. And that's Scotch. Raise a glass. When you think about it from that vantage point, it almost sounds like a religion, doesn't it? And this museum felt like what I imagine a flight of, do you say Scotches or Scotch, might be to a fan of that category of alcohol. They can all be different. They can all be good. They're all going to have features that they came to have because of their context and their history, as well as by those who gave them shape. And some are going to be better suited to one occasion than another. They can all also be misused and be destructive. As my friend the songwriter Steve Bell says of love, it can be like a sorrow for connoisseurs, right? It can gladden the heart and it can also destroy you. So kind of like that. This museum felt like what I imagine a flight of Scotch might be to somebody who loved that. So on balance, that little museum felt like it had more positive messages for me about hope, about the life-giving possibilities of how we as humans think, speak, reflect on, represent the thing that we make when we make religion or beliefs, than the Grand Cathedral that it sits next to. Now, having said that, it might also be the case that that museum needed the contrast of the cathedral to speak to me the way that it did. If we don't learn from our mistakes, the odds of repeating them do seem to go up. Quick little sidebar. There's this tiny bookstore, I don't remember where it was, but that we popped into, you probably will remember, Kareen, the one that had the disappointing affirmations book in it. Oh, man. Some of you might have seen this book. If you know what affirmations are at all, as a self-help technique, this was a whole book of, like, kind of negative affirmations, if you will. I just started flipping through it, and I'm standing in the bookstore, like, laughing, belly laughing out loud. They were really funny, darkly, in many cases. One that said, if I knew now what I didn't know then, I would have effed up my life totally differently. So that's just an example of the tone of the book in general. So maybe when I think about the way this museum behaves next to the cathedral, maybe I'm sort of seeing this through a half-full or maybe a half-empty glass of scotch, but that's the way it looked to me. Okay, last one. This one came courtesy of the Hunterian, which is the museum that's in the heart of Glasgow University. Glasgow University is the fourth oldest university in the UK, following behind, if I'm not mistaken, St. Andrews, Oxford, and Cambridge, and houses the oldest public museum in Scotland, which is this one. The University of Glasgow is a pretty good-sized institution, about the same size as U of M. I think currently they would say they have just under 28,000 registered students, but it's a bit older. It was founded in 1451 by order of the Pope. And its central and oldest building, which is simply called the College, which houses a museum, was built in 1630, which is, just for context, 200 years before the Dominion of Canada was formed. So well before anybody even had any notions about a university here. But that's what the College looks like. There are three different campuses, but this is the one that's just referred to that way. So that's the 1630 complex right there. Now, they are understandably proud of their heritage. The museum itself, the Hunterian, is named after an 18th century surgeon and anatomist, John Hunter. His samples and a bunch of his work are an important aspect of the collections. Just for a little bit of context, you kind of have to go inside all of this to get to it. This is what the porch for the museum looks like, essentially, right? So, you know, just that's kind of where you are architecturally and historically. Now, when you go into the actual museum, you go into the Great Hall, it's now a museum, and sort of from the end of the hall looking down, that's what the main room of the museum looks like. It's not the only room, but it's full of all kinds of displays that are a tribute to Hunter's legacy as a scientist, other noteworthy explorers of places, ideas. There's lots of artifacts from all over the world. You know what a museum's like, right? Like, there's bits of people's history in glass cases. In Europe with plaques on them that offer a predominantly Eurocentric perspective on those objects, where they came from, what they mean, all of that's beautifully put together, a remarkable collection in many regards. And then, if you come in on the main floor, so not this vantage point, but if you come in on the main floor and you're right-handed, there is this inclination to look to your right and see what's there, and that's where you start, right? And you go around the room. If you do that in this room, just as you're getting pulled into the exhibits, you encounter this. A declaration of discomfort. That's a little hard to read on the screen. Let me read the content to you. It's noteworthy. It says this: most museums are monuments to a system that privileges some people over others and creates a narrative about the identity of nations or cities that institutions seek to project and protect. Museums hold collections from donors who benefited from the practice of racial slavery, violent endeavors, forced removal, and the systemic oppression of indigenous peoples. Museums are political places. Curating discomfort, in quotes, so this particular initiative in the museum, in the Hunterian, creating discomfort puts forward discomforting provocations and interventions to help us to understand that museums have perpetuated ideologies of white supremacy, a political and economic and cultural system in which white Western ideas control the power of the texts, the material resources, and the actions that continue to underpin notions of cultural superiority. Colonial systems, such as the British Empire, use these ideologies to justify the enslavement and colonization of peoples and lands around the world. Museums developed within this context, and they remain spaces that celebrate and memorialize colonial systems. Collections, displays, and labels are a political act that have legacies rooted in colonialism. We are only now recognizing that we are not neutral, and that we have, without consideration, been complicit in perpetuating the ideologies of previous centuries. What a sentence. How about that? You know, an institution publicly wrestling with its own legacy, its own history, its own complicity. I'm not going to get into the details. You can look them up. But that engagement considers not just things like this curating discomfort perspective in an established museum, but the wider institution giving back a lot of money, billions of pounds, to donors where it's clear to them that that money was made through slavery or some of its attendant enterprises. And I'm not saying they got it all golden, right? But it's also a pretty big maneuver. What struck me here in what amounts to a temple to science was the confessional nature of this endeavor. That's why that last sentence gets to me the way that it does. We are only now recognizing that we are not neutral and that we have, without consideration, been complicit in perpetuating the ideologies of previous centuries. It might just be an on-ramp, but it feels like one that is headed in a potentially helpful direction. Speaking of which, a little further down the room, as part of a display reflecting on how the Jade Road trade route linking Asia and Europe carried not only goods but ideas, and how colonization and commercialism interfered with that movement, there was this question on the display. And again, I won't read the whole thing, but the last sentence asks this question. So the blurb there refers to the rich cultural cross-pollinization that happens when ideas flow between cultures, and then it asks in the very last sentence of this little plaque, which is written by somebody from a non-European culture, part of a working group of six who were really important in giving shape to the creating discomfort agenda. It asks this question. It asks, what happens when they stop traveling? What happens when the ideas stop traveling? What happens when the cross-pollinization stops happening? What happens when this isn't dialogic anymore? What happens when I'm taking it from you and keeping it for me? When I do that, it stops traveling. It's mine now. We were talking about this idea at supper last night with our kids, and Kale, who's had the occasion to see the British Museum, one of the kind of great European museums, he said, like, the British Museum did this like they wouldn't be there. Like, there's so many things would just no longer be in that building because they don't belong there. They don't belong to the people group that took them home and put them in a museum. They belong to somebody somewhere else. So this was written by somebody from that other perspective. What happens? What happens when ideas and the objects that represent them and provoke them and have made meaning in their context, what happens when those things stop traveling? And if that kind of questioning, if that kind of inquiry, it seems to me, can happen in a temple to science, then maybe it can happen in some other temples as well, including those that are in us, in our own hearts, where we hold sacred or remarkable or noteworthy things that might benefit from some examination, from being queried by some other perspectives, some other voices, the sorts of things that can keep us exploring what we believe for the betterment not only of ourselves, but also all of those around us. And that possibility remains, I continue to believe it in any case, that could be mutual. Even the notion that examining our own beliefs might primarily benefit us has the scent of cultural superiority about it. And when we see it from another vantage point, it can be like, oh, maybe the benefit would flow the other way. How about that? Anyway, lots there to consider. That's where I'm going to leave it for now. Peace.